Webcasting around the world from the desert metropolis of Phoenix, Arizona, this is The Dividing Line. The Apostle Peter commanded Christians to be ready to give a defense for the hope that is within us, yet to give that answer with gentleness and reverence. Our host is Dr. James White, Director of Alpha and Omega Ministries and an elder at the Phoenix Reformed Baptist Church. This is a live program, and we invite your participation. If you'd like to talk with Dr. White, call now at 602-973-4602 or toll free across the United States. It's 1-877-753-3341. And now with today's topic, here is James White.
And good afternoon. Welcome to The Dividing Line Thursday afternoon. I hope you saw the article that I posted last evening on the blog, or actually did it appear this morning? I posted last evening, but I may have had it show up like I do at 12:01 so that it has a different date stamp on it. U.S. military says Afghan Bibles have been destroyed. Bibles in Afghan languages sent to a U.S. soldier to base in Afghanistan were confiscated and destroyed to ensure the troops did not breach regulations which forbid proselytizing, a military spokeswoman said. Can you imagine if this article actually started out this way? Qurans in Afghan languages sent to a U.S. soldier at a base. Let's change this. Qurans in the English language sent to a U.S. soldier at a base in Georgia were confiscated and destroyed to ensure that troops did not breach regulations which forbid proselytizing, a military spokeswoman said. The riots in the streets, the KFCs, Pizza Huts, and McDonald's that would be burned down in Europe and, you know, places like, France, which is in Europe, but only barely, would be absolutely amazing. But where is the loud outcry that here you have these Bibles in the language of the people that you are living amongst, that you are having to have interaction with, that you talk with, but you can't tell them about Christianity? Now, let me ask you another question. What if you were a Muslim soldier in Afghanistan? What would you be allowed to do? See, all of this just takes me right back to the dimitude that we are already experiencing. People on the left, secularists on the left, just automatically slide into dimitude. Well, these people get really angry if we offend them, so we just need to do whatever we need to do. Now, we know Christians aren't going to do anything if we offend them, so we don't have to apply the same standards here. It is absolutely amazing. And you used to see, once in a while you'd see one story, and then a few weeks later, you'd see another story. Now you're seeing stories all the time about the freedom of speech of Christians being absolutely trampled upon all across Western society. And why is it happening? Dimitude. A dhimmi is a person who is allegedly under the protection of the Islamic State. Dimitude, hence, is submission as a non-Muslim to the Muslim state. The attitude of dimitude is being seen all across Europe today, where, for example, Home Secretary in the United Kingdom puts out a list, and the list says these people are not welcome in the United Kingdom. And there are murderers and bombers and all sorts of folks that I don't have any problem whatsoever with them keeping out of the United Kingdom, but they just happen to have a common first surname, like Muhammad. And so to try to decrease the offense of keeping well-known criminal jihadis out of the UK, they got plenty of them already, let's throw a few other people on there. Now, Fred Phelps is just such a cult-leading, I don't know what terms to use, such a cult leader. He's loopy? Oh, he's not just loopy. A goober. Okay. Thanks, Rich. Appreciate that. Whenever I can't find the right word, just ask Rich. Fred Phelps is such a goober. I don't blame anybody keeping him out.
I think he's actually related to Goober Pyle.
No, Goober was a nice guy, and Fred Phelps is not. That little cult is reprehensible. But be that as it may, I can certainly understand why they want to get. But there's all these other people they've thrown on there, like Michael Savage. I don't like listening to Michael Savage. He's the mirror image of what was that absolute disgusting man on Pull Out Your Hair America at Night. I think it was also Michael. Michael, remember? Yeah. And such a shame he's gone. No, not at all. I don't like listening to either of those radical kooky fringes, personally. But anyway, they threw them on there just for the fun of it, just to try to say, well, see, we're banning lots of people, not just Muslims. I tell you, it just, the only thing that is going to bring peace is changing people's hearts. And what are we doing? Oh, we don't want you giving anybody Bibles. No, you can't answer questions about what you believe, even though you're interacting with these people. Oh, it's an outrage, absolute outrage. But is anybody expressing outrage? Well, maybe one or two people, but I haven't seen anything on the news. People are too busy talking about Nancy Pelosi and the fact that I've seen some Mormon missionaries trying to answer a few questions about Joseph Smith that were about as consistent as Nancy Pelosi. Oh my! There are Mormons out there absolutely just wringing their hands and having compared to Nancy Pelosi. Sorry about that. That just sort of came out. didn't mean to go there. Well, we fired up the phone lines, and they got full like real fast. How many lines do we have? Are we full? We're full. And we have full like in the first 2 minutes, and I didn't even say 777-533-3341. So that's probably tells you might be a caller driven program today. We'll find out. All right, let's just for some reason the numbers. Oh, okay, the numbers are correct. All right, let's start with Arlen. Hi, Arlen, how are you?
Hi, I didn't hear. Are you saying Arlen?
Yes. Uh huh.
Okay, I heard a big fuzzy sound. Anyway,
fuzzy sound.
I appreciate all that wonderful music before the show started, by the way.
Oh, well, you know, we had some people in our chat channel didn't even know what it was, and I was like, wow.
Yes, I even identified it, first song. Anyway, my question is, a caller on a Tuesday mentioned the passage in John 8:3-11, and some manuscripts have it in Luke. Where the woman is caught in adultery. And my question for you is, how as Christians should we treat passages such as those? What use are they to us? For instance, if I'm in church one day and the pastor preaches a sermon on John 8:3-11, if it wasn't in the original manuscripts and it's not the Word of God, what value is it to us above anything else, like early church writings such as the Shepherd of Firmus or things of that nature?
Mm-hmm. That's a good question. A lot of people say, all right, if you don't, if you recognize that the Pericope Adulterae, John 7:53-11, and the longer ending of Mark are textually dubious and, in fact, from my perspective, are not canonical, I'm often asked, would you preach these passages if you were preaching through John? Like, I'm preaching through Hebrews right now. And I try to be consistent. When I preach through Hebrews, when there is a major textual variant there, I am going to tell people about it. I'm going to make mention of it. And there are some important textual variants, in fact, in the text of Hebrews. So I try to point those things out. And so if I were in a situation where I was preaching through John, you know, I could put the pastor on the hot seat here, because I could ask him what he would do. And we're live, and he's just grinning at me. I'm not going to drag the poor man in here and put him on a microphone, because he'd never speak to me again. But I would not preach the text. When I got done with John 7:52, I would especially if I had not addressed it in Sunday school, probably take a sermon to discuss the issue and introduce folks to the subject of textual criticism so they aren't just left wondering, why did my pastor skip a whole chunk of text? But, you know, I'd use it as an opportunity to make sure that people would understand what's going on there. But I would not preach it as part of canonical scripture, and I would end at John 16:8, and I would then have a discussion over why I think that's where it's supposed to end. Would again use it as an opportunity to not just leave a big hole in someone's understanding, but try to, you know, explain why I do certain, you know, do the things that I do. So, yeah, I wouldn't do that. And I think that's being consistent. And I think you have to be consistent. If you're gonna preach it, no matter what, anymore, people have those notes in their Bibles, and they look at them. At least I wish they would look at them a little more often, but they will look at them. Don't skip it. Don't ignore it. When you're teaching in a class situation, when you're teaching in any type of context like that, you have to recognize that in our world today, the Bart Ehrmans are out there. They're telling people these things, and you just have to deal with it on that level. You have to show folks what's going on. So that's how I would utilize it. Now, if I was listening to somebody else, it would bother me if it was just presented without any discussion, and I would have to recognize that most of the time it probably is.
I have the one advantage of having an ESV study Bible. The notes take up half the page.
Well, of course, if you have an ESV study Bible, you also have to go to the gym to work out to be able to carry it. I mean, you hit somebody with an ESV study Bible, and I'm sure a judge someplace has ruled that is assault with a deadly weapon.
And to extend on that, what about, for instance, the end of Mark? If Mark ended women going off and not telling anybody, how do you deal with such a unsatisfying ending?
I would try to point out that quote unquote lack of satisfaction is the primary reason why there were additional endings written. And since we have a number of people calling, I direct you to Dan Wallace's essay on that subject, where he explains why he feels that's perfectly consistent with Mark's methodology, and that speculation about a last page falling off and all the rest of that stuff is even less satisfying. So I would probably do an entire sermon on looking back over Mark. Why would we think that this would be a good way to end it? And just briefly, I would simply point out, Mark was not writing in a vacuum. We tend to think, like, when we write a book, we send the book out, and sometimes we treat it like it's going to be the only book anyone ever reads. But that's not what was going on. Mark's writing this within the context of the Christian community, within the context of people who are already preaching the gospel. It's not like he's thinking this is the only thing anyone's ever going to have. Anyone who has this book is already preaching Christ. So are there reasons why he would end the way that he ended? And I think that Dan Wallace goes over some of those fairly well. I think there's a Four Views book on that particular subject of the longer ending of Mark and stuff like that. So I would just use every one of them to try to increase the people's understanding of why the text in the New Testament they have is in the form that it is. Okay?
Well, thank you very much. And I'm glad that you got to the studio on time today.
All right. Thank you very much. Bye-bye. Bye. All right, let's, stay over in California. Those Californians need all the help they can get, and let's talk with Mark. Hi, Mark.
Hello, Dr. White.
How you doing?
I'm doing very well, thank you. My question is, I was listening to the Ehrman debate, and I also sent that to a couple of relatives, and in case they had this question, I wanted to ask you. But the one thing that surprised me in listening to it that I thought that was an interesting point that Dr. Ehrman made was that he said that we don't know when we go back and reconstruct the original text, we can't really know for sure if we actually got back to the autograph, right? If the autograph was somehow destroyed and we were going from a from a second or a third copy, we really wouldn't have any way to know that, would we?
Well, yeah, he raised the issue of saying, well, what if you have one of Paul's letters and it gets copied and it's that second copy that ends up producing the majority of other copies and things like that?
Exactly.
And he brought that up. It would have been nice if he had made that a part of his opening presentation. Unfortunately, he didn't, and it ended up coming up only in rebuttals and hence could not be fully discussed. This was one of the primary reasons that I raised the issue of multiple lines of transmission. Because let's just for the sake of argument for a moment, grant that that could happen in regards to Second Peter, or, well, he doesn't like Second Peter, so let's stay with Paul, Second Corinthians. The fact of the matter is that the originals did not just simply disappear. There is a period of time during which copying is still taking place, and the originals are still in existence. So even if in one instance you had something like that happening, it is a real stretch of the imagination to try to assert that with every book of the New Testament that happened. He's only presenting maybe this happened and we don't really know because we don't have the originals. And this is the whole idea of the radical skepticism that has become prevalent today, which was not a part of scholarship until the modern period. And that is when you have a stable and wide manuscript tradition, you function on the basis of innocent until proven guilty. Now it's guilty until proven innocent. And the problem is when you're talking about that kind of primitive period of transmission, as he himself says, yeah, that means we don't know what any book in antiquity read at all. So it's all or nothing proposition. Either you want to say we don't have a clue really what anybody wrote until computers came along. Or you have to go, well, wait a minute. We've never functioned on this basis before. Is there really a meaningful reason why we're functioning on it now? And I would suggest to you that the main reason that Bart Ehrman functions on that is because he's an agnostic and is making a ton of money attacking the Christian faith. But anyway, that's why I went back to the issue of the multiple lines of transmission. There isn't any reason to assume, especially... I think we were talking, which one did he use as the example? Did he use Galatians? Because that's sticking in my mind for some reason. Is that what he used? Rich is saying, Galatians?
I don't remember.
Yeah, well, let's use Galatians. Galatians is probably the worst book to use as an example for this for an obvious reason. Galatians was a circular letter. That's why it's Galatians, plural, in the sense of the churches of Galatia. It was a letter that was a circular letter. It was transmitted to numerous different locations. And the fact that we have one united manuscript tradition of Galatians is tremendous evidence of the accurate copying of that letter. You see, if this type of major alteration, and you gotta remember, for Bart Ehrman, even the smallest alteration can be turned into a major alteration. Remember when he pointed out the P52, it's not actually exactly the same. The variations, or one of them isn't even documented, but it's just assumed, the variations in John 18 found that in no way, shape, or form impact the meaning of the text at all. But a major variation there. You got to be really careful when he starts using that kind of terminology because what he considers to be major and what it would be translationally major are two very different things. But anyway, Galatians is the perfect test case because it is clearly distributed amongst, we know there would have been the copying process early on. And yet the manuscript tradition gives us no hint at all. We've never found a papyri manuscript of Galatians with an extra chapter, with 12 added verses. With a completely changed message. Nothing like that. And yet we know that it would have had to have been copied, so it could have been taken to each of those congregations right off the bat. And yet the manuscript tradition that we have, which is as early as the end of the second century, gives absolutely no evidence whatsoever of any kind of transmissional interruption. And that was one of the things that I was a little bit disappointed with, is that Bart Ehrman's argumentation against Kurt Ahlund's discussion of tenacity was a dismissive one of arrogance. It wasn't a scholarly argument. It was just, Kurt. I was honestly shocked that this man who is considered to be the greatest American textual critical scholar is so in love with his own press that he thinks that hobnobbing with the current crop of French textual critical scholars is somehow what makes your arguments right, rather than providing meaningful argumentation. I was truly taken aback in that cross examination period. It was pretty amazing. But anyway, he should have been able to provide some kind of argumentation that says, well, here are examples where we've clearly had this happen, where the manuscript evidence demonstrates to us that you had the original, and then you've got this branching off, and you've got radically different transmissions of this text. We don't have that. And
Do we not have that in any of the New Testament books?
No, we don't. What we have in all the New Testament books is what I was trying to get him to understand, which amazed me that, again, he didn't understand what I was saying. I talked about the spectrum of the most dissimilar traditions, the manuscript families, if you're familiar with the Alexandrian and Byzantine. And I compared the two together and said, here's the printed text that represents the Byzantine. Here's the printed text that represents the Alexandrian. Let's compare them. And he just had no idea why I was doing that. And I was taken aback by a number of things in the debate. That's one of the main reasons I was taken aback by that, is that I'm not the first one that's done this. I wasn't out on some cutting edge. I think my keynote presentation is probably the best he'd ever run into, but because most text critical scholars, once it comes to trying to do something like that, they just get lost. But I've heard other people. Dan Wallace had done this the previous year. He had talked about the manuscript traditions and stuff like that, and he hadn't balked at any of that stuff. So I just did not understand that. But when we look at the New Testament, now different books will have. How would we describe it? Revelation, for example, has the smallest number of manuscripts that we can go on, and so you can see certain families in Revelation, but still you only have one text, Revelation. There are variations you struggle with. It doesn't have as much textual background as, for example, the Gospels, which have the most, but still it follows the same pattern that the rest of the New Testament does. The burden of proof lies upon the person who is making the accusation that the earliest and most widely attested manuscript tradition from antiquity of any work at all had fundamental editing, changing, or corruption in the earliest time period that changes the meaning of the text. And they aren't bearing that burden. They're just sort of going, well, we've already proved that, and they're moving on because that's just where scholarship wants to go right now. And it's a sad thing to watch, especially institutions that were once founded by conservative Christians promoting that kind of stuff. It's a shame to observe all of it.
Right. Well, it seems to me the clear point that you made here was that it's not like the New Testament existed as a monolith that was all copied at once and then transmitted.
Oh, no.
They're all transmitted as individual, books for a long time, I guess. And,
well, originally they're transmitted as individual books. Within the first 100 years, you have collections coming together. You've got the Gospels coming together.
Right.
Interestingly enough, Luke, Acts would have been together originally. Acts textual history has been impacted by the fact that Luke was disassociated from Acts and put into the Gospel collection, and Luke was sort of left, was sort of left on its own at that point, and that has impacted its textual transmission. But then you have the Pauline corpus found in P46 and things like that. So very early on, you have portions of the New Testament coming together. It doesn't take long before all of it comes together, even though it still circulates in portions. I mean, especially during the period of persecution. This was something that I haven't seen it on the video. I actually haven't watched the entire debate on video. I rarely go back and do those things unless I'm going to be debating the same person over again. But I was told by people in the audience that frequently, whenever I'd mention the subject of persecution, that Dr. Ehrman would roll his eyes.
Right. I was kind of looking for that. I don't think the camera caught it.
But I had a number of people around the front row that were watching him intently, and I got multiple reports of that from different people. So I don't have any reason to question it.
Right.
I did get some shots of some pretty odd looks on his face during things I was saying from pictures that people gave me. So I'm not surprised by that. I didn't get a chance to bring this up, but I think I did on a Dividing Line sometime later. I brought up a scholarly article, brand new scholarly article that I'd been reading that morning in the hotel, which again, thanks to the internet, I've been able to purchase online and download that quickly. It's amazing what you can do these days. But it was about some papyri manuscripts that have been found that in essence documented what had been taken during one of the imperial persecutions. The imperial persecutions against the church really became most intense at the end of the 3rd century, right before they ended, right before the peace of church in 313. So from about 260 to about 300, that 40-year period there, is where you have really the most intense persecution empire-wide of the Christian church. And one of these articles I was reading was about what they had taken from this one church. And if I'm recalling correctly, I think I put it on the blog, actually, now that I think about it. I'm not sure if I discussed it on the DL or not, but I may have put it on the blog. It discussed the fact that from this one church, they took 46 codices. This is one church. Now, we know of at least 300 different churches this happened to. How many manuscripts were destroyed during that period of time? I mean, there had been a lot of manuscript production at that point, and to ignore the role of persecution in the production of New Testament manuscripts in that time period, I think is just absolutely foolhardy. But it isn't a major emphasis in a lot of what I read today in New Testament textual studies. They're much more interested in climbing into the brains of a later scribe and finding out if he was anti-woman so as to slam Christianity. I'm serious. Or he's anti-Jewish, or he's anti-this, or anti-that. They want to try to mind-read scribes. And I can just hear someone saying, well, you mind-read scribes, too, because you say that the scribe would have, in Colossians 1, would have had Ephesians 1:7 in mind. You're mind-reading him, too. The standard form of textual criticism recognizes that people are influenced by liturgy. They're influenced by what they're familiar with. They're influenced by errors of sight, errors of hearing, that kind of thing. That's not what I'm talking about. That's not what's become popular these days. What's become popular these days is to mind read the person's beliefs and somehow determine that, well, this was a scribe who was very anti-woman, and so he made these changes here, he made those changes, that type of stuff. And that's leading to, I think, a lot of really, really a waste of paper coming out from scholarship.
Or it's like you said, they're not really interested in getting back to the
original. No, they're not. And they admit it. Ehrman's admitted it. In fact, I think one of the things that I've seen in a number of the reviews of the debate that I've read is people said, I got him to say things that nobody else got him to say. And that was my purpose. I wanted him to go on record as saying these things. And other than the fact that he absolutely positively refused to say anything about the Quran, I don't know nothing about Islam. What are you talking about? I'm only the head of the Department of Religion. I don't know anything about Islam. other than that, a number of the statements that he made about the New Testament being the earliest, most widely attested work from antiquity and all the rest of this stuff, and yeah, we don't have a clue what anybody back then wrote, and these things, those were things that I wanted to have very clearly presented. And I thought one of the best one was ginormous. that one, because I had listened to him make that assertion in a radio interview with Justin Brierley over in the United Kingdom, and I remember exactly where I was on the trail when he said that. I was listening to it the first time, and I said, man, that's just so inconsistent to say there's this huge gap between the originals and the first, when he knows that of any work of antiquity, we're talking about hundreds of times closer than anything else. So I was very thankful that ended up coming out. So anyhow, hopefully that's useful to you.
It was very useful. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much for calling. Thanks. All righty. Boy, we've already got the first half hour. Where did it go? Oh, we've still got two folks online. We got to get to, oh my goodness. Sorry, Joe. I probably would have jumped to you earlier, but he's calling from Dublin. So we'll take our break real quick and then start right back with Joe. We'll be right back.
BibleWorks 8 is here. Full of innovative and essential tools, users will have 190-plus Bible translations, 35 original language text and morphology databases, 29 lexical grammatical references, and an abundance of additional resources. Pastors, you will appreciate the phrase matching tool, which will allow you to find all of the verses containing phrases similar to your search verse, giving you greater depth and keener insight during sermon preparation. Seminary professors and students will be enriched by the way BibleWorks 8 shows the most common words in the pericope, book, or chapter, plus provides a wider range of formatting options and faster access to copying preferences. Scholars, your research just got easier with the ERMI, External Resources Manager, a handy tool to collect, organize, and display resource files from your computer as well as the internet. Dr. James White says, BibleWorks is the best Bible software available. I have used BibleWorks software for years, and each new release has brought many new and useful tools to the program. This is the program that runs 24/7 on my office computer, and it is the one that's running on my laptop when I engage in debates. It is simply the number one research tool for anyone doing serious exegesis of the text. For over 15 years, BibleWorks has assisted all users in their study of the original languages, and that enables you to do one thing, focus on the text. And that translates to focusing on the truth. Order your copy of BibleWorks at aomen.org, and for a limited time, you'll receive free shipping and a free MP3 download of the White Airman Debate.
The Trinity is a basic teaching of the Christian faith. It defines God's essence and describes how He relates to us. James White's book, The Forgotten Trinity, is a concise, understandable explanation of what the Trinity is and why it matters. It refutes cultic distortions of God, as well as showing how a grasp of this significant teaching leads to renewed worship and deeper understanding of what it means to be a Christian. And amid today's emphasis on the renewing work of the Holy Spirit, The Forgotten Trinity is a balanced look at all three persons of the Trinity. Dr. John MacArthur, senior pastor of Grace Community Church, says, James White's lucid presentation will help layperson and pastor alike. Highly recommended. You can order The Forgotten Trinity by going to our website at aomen.org.
Hello, everyone. This is Rich Pierce. In a day and age where the gospel is being twisted into a man-centered self-help program, the need for a no-nonsense presentation of the gospel has never been greater. I am convinced that a great many go to church every Sunday, yet they have never been confronted with their sin. Alpha and Omega Ministries is dedicated to presenting the gospel in a clear and concise manner, making no excuses. Man is sinful and God is holy. That sinful man is in need of a perfect Savior, and Jesus Christ is that perfect Savior. We are to come before the holy God with an empty hand of faith in the Lord Jesus Christ. Alpha and Omega takes that message to every group that we deal with, while equipping the body of Christ as well. Support Alpha and Omega Ministries and help us to reach even more with the pure message of God's glorious grace. Thank you.
And welcome back to the Dividing Line. Let's head across the pond and talk with Joe in Dublin. Hello, Joe.
Hey, James. How are you?
Doing good.
Good, good. I have a question on Arminianism, please. Basically, my question is, I was listening to a message on Perseverance of the Saints by Dr. John MacArthur.
Uh-huh.
And he basically talked on the issue of eternal security that... you know, by excluding that from the doctrine of salvation itself, the way like a hardcore Arminian would,
yes,
distort the gospel incredibly. And on that line of thinking, would you class Arminianism like the early followers of John Calvin would as heresy, or if not, is there a certain line that it gets to where it becomes heretical? That's just my question.
Yeah. Well, when Arminianism began to grow as a movement, it was identified as a return to Rome, because in many ways it is. On the fundamental issues of the nature of God's grace, the nature of man, Arminianism is popeless Catholicism at that point. It is incoherent and inconsistent on so many different grounds. And a consistent Arminian who goes all the way. And remember, modern Arminianism, Arminius himself would be almost seen as Calvinistic in comparison to modern Arminianism. But you can see where modern Arminianism has gone in open theism and inclusivism. It has no stopping point before it gets to universalism in many forms. And so if an Arminian goes to the point of denying sola gratia and sola fide, and goes to the point really presenting a work salvation system, then it can definitely become heretical. The vast majority of Arminians I know of, first of all, don't know they're Arminians. I'm reminded of, have you seen, because everybody's posted in channel, and I've had the temptation of actually doing something with it, but it is just so incoherent and so sad that I think people would accuse me of picking on unarmed people in an intellectual fight. But there is this this video on YouTube of this red-haired lady, and it's TikTok Productions or something like that. And it's a 31-minute video where she demonstrates once and for all, answers the question whether you should be a Calvinist. And it is just so sad. I mean, this lady has no earthly idea that she is following a particular theological construct. She really thinks that she's just reading the Bible. She's just reading it for what it says. And she has no idea that the influences that have formed her particular position. And as such, then, she can say, well, to be a Calvinist is to break the command of Paul, where he says you're not supposed to follow after men, and blah, 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 blah. Most people who are theologically Arminian are so by tradition. Thankfully, most of them are not consistent. I think consistent Arminianism could become heretical and might be heretical in its most consistent forms, but I've met very few consistent Arminians. I have met a lot of folks, and when you run into them, you know, they're the ones who are very quick to get rid of original sin and stuff like that. There's some folks I've met there that I would definitely say have scampered off into the realms of heresy, but the vast majority of the people that I talk to that are Arminian in their theology are so simply by default. They still say that we're saved solely by God's grace and solely through faith. Have they ever thought through their own position? No, they haven't. But I remember as a 19-year-old, you know who made me think that through for the first time? Was a Mormon missionary. We had this Mormon missionary over. And we were standing in my little teeny tiny library. I had all of one shelf of LDS books at that time. He was impressed by that, but in comparison to what I've gotten out, wasn't much. But standing there talking about the gospel with him, he put his finger on the inconsistency of my position because I hadn't yet come to understand what Reformed theology was. And that was extremely useful in helping me to see that. That I was saying one thing to him, but believing something else in my own position. And so, I agree with Dr. MacArthur that the people who refuse to accept God's sovereignty, God's decree of election, his purpose in the sacrifice of Christ, but then tack perseverance on at the end are grossly warping the gospel. There's no question about that. It's an incoherent position to hold, and that's a position many people hold. Many, Dave Hunt and others, even though his view of perseverance is more of a non-lordship weirdness position. But people who want to say that you can never lose your salvation, and yet say you're the one who gets you into it, are just contradicting themselves, and everybody knows it. It's obvious, and it does lead to all sorts of strange aberrations and imbalances and things like that. But I prefer to refer to Arminianism as a sub-biblical perspective that is tainted with humanism. The hypers are so big on calling everybody a heretic and drawing the circle so narrow that only they can stand it and only on one foot. I'd rather give the benefit of the doubt, believe them when they say they believe in sola fide and sola gratia, than use that as the foothold and press the consistency of those truths. And let's face it, there's a lot of people in this audience right now that are Reformed today because that's how I've approached it. And I don't know if they would have been, and I'm only speaking hypothetically here, had I taken a different perspective. So that's the way I approach it.
Oh, okay. I also just wanted to say, you mentioned in your last program about the idea for evangelism for the droids.
Yes, uh-huh.
I just wanted to... I'll forgive my vote there on that. I think it's a very good idea, and you know, I think the more variety you can come up with, like for JW's Mormons, the better, really. It'd be really good.
Yeah, see, here's for an update for folks. I'm glad you brought that up. We have found a fellow wrote in. We've had a number of people write in, and all of them have been positive, at least all of them I've seen. I haven't seen anybody write in say, no, that'd be terrible. He found a place online where they print these business card type things, and you can, and in one end of it, there is a pop out, so it obviously gets a little thicker on that end, but there is a pop out jump drive. And so it's printed on both sides. So you can have a logo on it, or obviously what we would want to do would be have designed something. We have great graphics folks. Haseem, son of Ramallah, king of graphics, could come up with something for, a general defense of faith, Mormonism, Roman Catholicism, Jehovah's Witnesses, a defense of the deity of Christ, explanation of the Trinity. I mean, we could do one on the Trinity, where you have debates with Mormons, debates with oneness people, debates with Jehovah's Witnesses. And we've got a lot to draw from. We really do. And so the problem is, though, that and the price is really good. The price is just as good as the jump drives we were looking at before, and yet you can get printing on both sides, would be to start off with the general defense of the faith ones to try to get it going. We've got to be able to generate some stuff here because we just don't have the cash reserves lying around to say, okay, we're going to buy 500 of these and 500 of that. You know, you're talking $10,000 pretty easily when you start doing something like that. So we've got to start with the core, and then as they move and are hopefully keep moving, use that to generate the other ones and put this stuff out there. And I know I'd carry a set with me for the conversations that I get into folks with, and I think other people would too. I had someone write and said their church would want to get them and stuff like that. So it's just a matter of starting with the first set and then starting to develop the others as the finances become available. So maybe what I need to do is put up a blog article that says, okay, here's what each one's going to be. We're going to start with this one, but if you're in Utah or something like that and you want the Mormonism one, then contact us. Let us know how many you'd be willing to purchase. And then we could, you know, maybe accelerate some of those things if people had a need for specific ones that would go into other areas. So that's where we are on that. I think it will be a neat idea.
Okay, thanks very much. Okay.
All right. Thank you, Joe. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
That's pretty late over there. Joe sounds a little tired. I think Joe's getting ready to go to bed.
And if I don't miss my guess, I don't think you tried your English accent once. I was really proud
of you. But
he's
Irish.
I was really proud of you there.
He was Irish.
Well, he was across the pond, and that usually is something you just can't resist.
He's Irish.
You know? It hasn't mattered in the past.
If he was Scottish, I would have started talking to him immediately. And I'm sorry I didn't do that. I guess there's many who out there in Radioland are very disappointed that I did not talk to him in that way. But I can do the rest of the program if you'd like. We had another caller, but he dropped off. Not because of that, by the way. In any way, shape, or form. So he can call back.
Everybody in channel's mad at me.
That's okay, because you're the one that brought it up. I just wasn't thinking about it. I was actually thinking about answering his question. But someday Roger's going to have to call him, because then you'd be able to tell that I have been tutored by the best. Or I'm going to call Jim Handyside and have Jim Handyside on. That would be so much fun to have the pastor.
I don't think they're coming on after that claim.
Oh, my. Well, anyway, we have we have fun. Okay, so since we cleared the board of calls last time that we were on the program, in the last 15 minutes here, actually 14 minutes of airtime, I was playing a section from the interview between Dan Barker and on Free Thought Radio and Bart Ehrman. And we had played one of the obvious, clear, uncontroversial, everybody knows it's true, contradictions, and had demonstrated that it wasn't. We went through the text, demonstrated that there were consistent, sober, non-begging of the question answers to every one of the texts that people have pointed to in the Gospel of John to try to make John contradictory with the synoptics, and that, in fact, a meaningful reading of each one made John consistent with the synoptics and not in contradiction. I have never heard anyone in any of the interviews that Ehrman has done. This is one of his favorite ones. He throws it all the time. You can tell he's not even thinking when he does it because he's done it so often. I've never heard anyone challenge him on it. Not once. None of the people who've interviewed him have ever done, you know, enough homework to check into it. Nothing like that. And that this is just what we face in United States today. You know, people ask me all the time. They go, how come you haven't debated Dawkins or haven't debated Christopher Hitchens? Well, actually, Christopher Hitchens called the dividing line once, remember? Not quite, but someone pretending to be Christopher Hitchens did. But I go, I would enjoy the opportunity. I really would. But that opportunity has never arisen. And something else out there, and this is especially for our Muslim apologist listeners, we don't roll around in dough over here in the United States. There is this rumor going around. Remember, I played the clip from this Muslim and Friends program, Islam and Friends program, a few weeks ago, where they were talking about how we were supposed to pay to fly this guy from India to the United States. And I'm like, excuse me, but we have flown some people in before. When we had a cruise and a conference, which means people were signing up, which means there was a source of income. And even then, we kept things extremely tight in how we did that stuff. I don't know where people get this idea. Maybe it's all Hasim, son of Ramallah's fault because the website looks so good or something like that. They figure that we're just rolling in the dough. We are not. The speaker's fees that these people demand are four numbers long and sometimes five numbers long, and we don't got that kind of money. And most of the time, when I'm in a debate, the other guy's getting paid, and I'm not. That's just how it works. So, you know, when people are like, well, you should have taken this person or that person on. Well, when they have a $20,000 speaker fee and you'll plunk the money down, you'll pay their speaker's fee, you'll fly them in, you'll put them up, you'll pay that. I'll do it. I would be happy to do it. If there's somebody out there and you're sitting on a wallet that just keeps getting bigger and bigger and bigger, and you want to arrange something like that, you want to get Christopher Hitchens or Richard Dawkins or something like that, be happy to do it. But the fact of the matter is it takes lots of money to make things like that happen. In fact, when William Lane Craig debated, I think it was Christopher Hitchens at Biola recently, did you notice that if you wanted to watch the live feed, it was $89? $89 fee to watch. That's what it cost. Why? Well, because they got to pay the guy. And he ain't cheap. And so that's just you know, the reality of how it works. So that's where we go. So anyways, we're listening to this section of the debate. I'm sorry, the interview. And let's pick it up right where we left off.
So what year was Jesus actually born?
Oh, well, that's a great question, and we don't really know. The calendars that we have today, we know that they're not accurate, because if Jesus was born during the rule of Herod the Great, well, Herod the Great died in the year 4 B.C., which creates this delicious irony that Jesus was born at least 4 years before Christ.
Well, if he was born.
Did you catch that? Annie Laurie Gaylor there says, well, if he was born, because, again, you got to remember, the Freedom from Religion Foundation is on the left side of the, would you call it the left side or the right side, now that I think about it, of the atheistic movement. They tend to be more radical in their atheism rather than the more liberal atheists who tend to be less radical or something. I'm not sure how exactly where you put the spectrum there. But they're closer to the American atheists than they are some of the others. And they like to throw out this, well, we don't really even know that Jesus existed, blah, blah, blah. And as you're going to see, Bart Ehrman doesn't go there.
Yeah, I think most historians agree that Jesus really did exist. Although there are a lot of people now who are doubting that and wondering about it. But there's pretty good evidence Jesus existed. The big question is, you know, what he really said and did.
And then you point out in your book that Luke reports that he was born when Quirinius became the governor of Syria, which was later.
Yeah, that's another contradiction, because Quirinius wasn't the governor of Syria until AD 6. Or...
By the way, that wouldn't be a contradiction. That would be a historical error. A contradiction is where you say one thing and then say something else otherwise. I'm not sure why you use that terminology. And there are extensive discussions of how much we actually know about Quirinius. It's interesting that critics of the Christian faith are very quick to do what they very strongly condemn in a lot of less than sound proponents of the Christian faith. And that is, they are willing to be very certain about things in history when they can turn it into an error in the Bible. Whereas they're very quick to point out the Christians, and they're right about this, Christians often will take small amounts of information and turn them into huge stories in support of the Bible. The discussion of exactly when Quirinius was governor in Syria and the issues related to that is a very complex discussion. And it just seems to me that once again we're up against the guilty until proven innocent situation. Here's a situation where you have someone whose track record, when we can check the track record against known historical fact, archaeologically speaking, documentarily speaking, when we can find, you know, written documents or inscriptions and things like that. Luke is incredible. Absolutely incredible. And so the idea is, well, we have some information that Quirinius is governor at this point, or began to be governor at this point, and yeah, okay, so the possibility exists that he's governor more than once, because that was not an uncommon event in history, but we've got this one thing, and so he's guilty until proven innocent. We're just going to, you know, nail it down here, because we don't really know what was going on at the time, but we know this later on, and so we're going to nail him. It's that kind of simplistic argumentation that, to me, is demonstrative, once again, of critics of Christianity that just simply are not there for the truth value. They're there to make their point.
Fix CE, as we say, which was 10 years after Herod the Great died. So Luke can't be right that Herod the Great was on the throne at the same time Quirinius was the governor, and that that's when Jesus was born. And well, so it's another contradiction.
Why should a typical believer, say an evangelical or, you know, half-hearted Methodist listening to this program, why should they care about those contradictions?
Well, I think the half-hearted Methodist might not care all that much,
he's right. Is he not right? I mean, look at the United Methodist Church today. Look at what it's doing, and these folks know who believers are, and listen to what he's about to say.
A Christian going to a liturgical church like the Episcopal Church or the Catholic Church, but a Christian who goes to a church that is based on the infallibility of the Bible, I think we'll find this kind of information troubling, because the Bible's not infallible. There are mistakes in it. And so I don't think that destroys Christianity. As I said, for years and years I was a Christian while I acknowledged that the Bible was completely fallible. But it does force somebody to change their view of the Bible, at least, recognizing what historical scholars have long been saying about the New Testament.
Well, and once again, notice from these folks' worldview, if you're a historical scholar, and remember, I told you, we had a phone conversation before the debate, and he is, and I'm not, from his perspective. That's just how he thinks. You know, if you agree with me, then you're in the group. If you disagree with me, you're not in the group. I mean, there can be disagreements in the group. He recognizes that. He loves, he's quite irascible when it comes to the meetings that he is a part of. He's a bit of a firebrand. But clearly, from their mindset, you are not a critical scholar. You're not even a scholar, truly, unless you embrace their methodology, their conclusions, sip lattes with the leading French textual critical scholars, so on and so forth.
I used to be like you used to be, a true believer, you know, a door knocker and a street corner preacher. And for someone like me, it's true, not for all believers, you know, the more moderate, but for someone like me, that was extremely important. One little tiny mistake in the supposed inerrant, perfect Word of God cast some suspicion or some doubt on the reliability of the other witnesses.
Absolutely. I mean, I think for very strong evangelical Christians and for fundamentalists, just one chink in the armor makes the whole thing fall apart. And so that's why I think it's important for people to look at the evidence that I cite in the book, and that scholars have long known that, in fact, there are these contradictions, because it just isn't worth it to believe something that's not true.
Now, of course, that would have lots of weight in it if there is any evidence that Bart Ehrman actually followed his own advice. But the fact of the matter is, it's very clear he does not listen to the other side's responses. He does not accurately represent them. He misrepresents them. And when you do that, then it pretty much labels you as a hypocrite. When you tell people, well, you shouldn't believe things are untrue, but you are popping off with this stuff, and you should know that there are solid responses to it, but you don't even acknowledge that they're there, and you don't take them into account in your teaching.
I'm Annie Laurie Gaylor with Dan Barker for Free Thought Radio. We're talking with Bart Ehrman, a Bible scholar, best-selling author, and agnostic, and we'll be right back to finish our conversation with him.
Hello, my name's Bernie from Sarnia on
Trinity in the New Testament.
Right.
I'm skipping past that, obviously.
With a right-wing apologist-type Christian guy.
Oh, now,
all
here.
Those people.
Here. Now, this is funny. After the break, Dan Barker mentions he's about to debate me, but he doesn't mention me. Doesn't mention my name. I'm just a right-wing apologist-type guy. Okay? He didn't even bother, like I said, didn't even bother looking it up. I'm just a right-wing apologist-type guy. And I, you know, that could be offensive if it had some meaning behind it, but it really doesn't, so it's not overly offensive to me. Anyway, what would have happened? What would have happened if he had mentioned me? Oh, how different this interview would have been, but listen to this.
Now, Bart Ehrman, I'm going to be doing a debate in a couple of weeks in Illinois on the topic, does the triune God of Scripture live with a right-wing apologist-type Christian guy? I'm sure you know a lot of those people. And in your first book that I, well, the, one of the books that I just read of yours, I'm Misquoting Jesus, you talk about the problem of the Trinity in the New Testament.
Now, did you catch that? Dan just read Misquoting Jesus. It was a New York Times bestseller in religion in 2005. 4 years later, he's just now getting around to reading it. I'm sorry, but Dan's not exactly on the cutting edge of keeping up with one of the main fields. And that brings me back, since we're almost out of time, to a brief exchange we had during the debate. It was actually during the break. I had mentioned to the Navigator students that were there during the lunch beforehand some of the arguments that Dan would raise, and he raised every one that I said that he would raise, pretty much in the order I said he'd raise them. So I just happened, after sort of from the stage, sort of talking to them from a distance, I said to Dan, I said, yeah, I mentioned Navigators that, you know, you're going to talk about Thor's Day, and I, you know, went through all your arguments. And this is what he said to me. He said, well, those are good arguments, he says. Those arguments are why I'm an atheist. Now, think, it struck me at that time. I didn't get into an argument with him. I was Mr. Nice Guy, but it struck me at that time. Do you see the thinking there? It's so clear. Those arguments have to be good because that's why I'm an atheist. And that strikes me as pretty circular thinking. That's why he can just keep repeating them, no matter how often they're knocked out of the ballpark, no matter how often they're refuted, no matter how often they're shredded. He's just going to keep repeating them, because if he didn't repeat them, he couldn't remain an atheist. Think about it. Anyway, we'll continue on with that. Didn't get very far through it because I started talking about other things. But thanks for all the phone calls today. Great phone calls. Lots of neat topics. We'll be back with you, Lord willing, on Tuesday. See you then. God bless.
The Dividing Line has been brought to you by Alpha and Omega Ministries. If you'd like to contact us, call us at 602-973-4602 or write us at P.O. Box 37106, Phoenix, Arizona 85069. You can also find us on the World Wide Web at aomin.org. That's aomin.org, where you'll find a complete listing of James White's books, tapes, debates, and tracts. Join us again next Tuesday morning at 11 a.m. for The Dividing Line. I'm